So, without visual aids, unless you want to use the slides on Blackboard, but I suggest probably just listen at present, and then we'll go through that. I want to spend a bit of today's session doing part one of what I'm referring to as group psychologies and the techniques that are actually used with respect to that. I mean, before Reading Week, we talked about nudge theory, we talked about the psychology of persuasion. We looked a little bit at how neuro-linguistic programming was provided. What I really want to get into today is that notion of the group. I spent the last 3 days actually in Great Yarmouth with a fascinating collection of individuals who were very much in terms of cultural subcultures from the sort of science fiction world, etc. And clearly there's a sort of commonality within that. Those of you who are watching the Rugby World Cup final and seeing another humiliating defeat for England will have seen, obviously, another sort of subculture, which is sort of sporting subcultures, etc. But groups, obviously, are organic. They diversify. They exist in all sorts of different ways. You know, part of the collective group of undergraduate students, but within that, you're a subgroup of people who are specialising in areas relating to communications, public relations, journalism, and so on. And at all levels, there are developments within there. But let's talk a bit about the sort of the key styles of group that are actually there. And broadly, there are seven that have been identified in terms of the styles of group that you can actually have. And I'll give you some examples there. You can have command groups. So in any organisation, you can have a hierarchical structure in which clearly there is a senior management, there's a middle management, there's an operations level, and there might even be a customer level as well. But there are various elements that usually relate to a supervisor and subordinates. Hence the reason I use the term hierarchical, because it kind of works on those bases. You also get groups that are referred to as task groups. Groups that are specifically formed with the intention of having a commonality, a common aim, a common goal. Signet PR obviously designates particular groups in terms of particular activities. Anybody here involved with the Chris Packham? Actually, right, fine. Well, there's a classic case of that, you know, spreading the word, following the thing through. And I'm presuming actually that also might mean you might find tomorrow tricky to attend, possibly.
Yeah, the talk's between 3 and 4, so we won't be able to be here tomorrow, but we'll come speak to you to catch up.
Yeah. You won't be here because we won't be here, but obviously in the other room, that's okay, actually. We're in a different room. We're in the other building.
Oh, right.
It's all right, Eleanor. I'm not so just throwing this in. Well, I'll turn up and be at the lecture. You know,
that'd
so exactly. So
we've
really
got 10 people.
Yeah, there we are. Then. Right. So, which is a case in point. Will you be coming tomorrow, Joe, to see the Chris Packham talk?
I didn't know about it.
You see.
It would really
this is the reason. Well, I was and Carlotta. Were you aware of this lecture by Chris Packham, who's a very famous television personality here?
No,
didn't know. Did you know about this, Amy?
You see, the thing is, we got the information about it 2 weeks ago, Thursday, before Reading Week.
So what we've got now, then, is a real opportunity with a task group to actually spend a couple of minutes explaining to Izzy and Joe and Carlotta and Amy why they need to actually turn up tomorrow with yourselves and myself to actually be there. Otherwise, you'll be very disappointed.
It's 3 till 4, so you can squeeze
it.
Oh yeah, if you're
exactly.
It's
not like having yes, you do. If you, is your timetable free between 3 o'clock in the afternoon and 4 o'clock?
Yes.
Right. In which case
you
need.
Sign yourself up.
Yes.
You've got 11 till 5.
Yeah. No, we've got to be engaged as well. We've got to be like, come on, let's do it.
So you need to basically, I mean, let us know, let all of us know so they can write the thing down exactly where it is, when it is, and where they need to be at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
It's Minerva Building. What's it called? The lecture theatre on the right. I can't remember what it's called.
Cargill, I think.
That's the one, yeah. And it's at 3 till 4 tomorrow, and it's a lecture and a Q&A session with Chris Packham himself, discussing Extinction Rebellion.
and in particular the posters which have been circulated for quite some time now by Greta Thunberg, who you may have heard of, Swedish soul, criticised quite heavily by Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, for reasons which may or may not have some logic and stand up, about the notion of how dare you. So actually it does fulfil the criteria of what we would talk about nudge theory, how you persuade people to change aspects and also relate to other elements. So, you know, from that point of view, here am I in support of the Signet PR team, showing basically how it could be very useful to actually be there at 3 o'clock in the Cargill Lecture Theatre. Yeah. Do they need to register?
You should do, but as if you could email Signet PR to let them know that you would like to come, that'd be great. But if not, there's only 10 people that have at the moment signed up, so.
So we need to enhance that with 15, right? So, again, that's part of the challenge that you're faced with. So, Izzy, will you be there, or will you be saying, no, I'm not going to come in at all now?
Probably not. I thought I really sold it.
Amy.
Oh, no, I've got the orthodontist, so I wouldn't do it if I didn't have
that. Oh, it's all right, don't worry about it, don't worry.
Amy. Yes, I probably will, because it's only an hour.
I think it will be interesting.
Yeah,
I think it will be quite... I agree. Because I barely know anything, to be honest, like, since you're running, I really should look it up, but...
So will you be there, Amy?
Yes.
Joe?
Yes.
Just think how you could actually use it to actually support one of your essay theories and lines from that.
Right,
and Carlotta?
Yes.
Yes. You will be there?
Yeah, I don't know where.
Explain for Carlotta where the Cargill Lecture Theatre is. Other building, Minerva.
Building.
And it's one of the two small lecture theatres as you're going in at 3 o'clock tomorrow.
Yeah.
And lecture 4 till 5.
Yeah, 4 till 5. Yeah. Yeah, I was confused why you were like,
I was thinking
there.
It was 3 till 4.
No, I'm not.
Right, no.
Because I will be at both, exactly.
Yeah, yes, precisely. And I thought it was.
I know, Eleanor, exactly. Five. Nice try, but.
No, I wasn't trying. Yeah.
Okay, so there's an example of how, in terms of task group, that's just on a limited basis, how you sort of subject. But that's the second. The third type of group that you've got is what's referred to as a functional group. Okay? And a functional group is one which effectively does things within a within basically an unspecified time frame. So it's not necessarily stuff which has to be done. But they will actually do, I suppose in academic terms, it's a case of timetablers. They will there's obviously a deadline for when they need to get a timetable out, but they will start collating details February of the year for the upcoming year and so on, and they are a functional group. Then the fourth style of group that you've got, which needs to be borne in mind, are informal groups. And informal groups can relate to anything from societies that you join, sporting clubs that you might join, possibly political things. They're not necessarily tied in with work. They might just be interests, hobbies, hobby groups. I use the term cultural subcultures to actually outline what we're talking about when you are discussing, as I say, science fiction fans or sporting fans or any of those particular aspects. They all sort of are pretty much informal. Or they might, again, just be, they have a common interest in, say, the literature of William Blake, or 19th century working, or ecology, or the environment, and so on. They also fall into the notion of interest groups. And then, of course, we've got that other interesting one, which is friendship groups. Because in any particular society, you have people who will connect, not necessarily on the basis of shared interests, although that can be part of it, but because actually they are just friends with particular individuals, so they connect on that basis. And then, perhaps most interesting in terms of the list of seven types of groups, and the final one I want to refer to today, is what are referred to as reference groups. Now, reference groups aren't groups where you simply look to how to do a bibliography, or how to actually do footnotes or endnotes properly. But they're a group who basically will effectively be set up to validate yourselves within the social hierarchy. You know, are you a member of a particular golf club, for instance, or a particular society, or a particular area? That's kind of demonstrating which group you're actually joining. Are you part of the club? Are you part of G8 countries? Are you part of the developed societies? Are you part of the technical societies? Where are you sort of connecting from that? So just to update, you've got command groups, you've got task groups, you've got functional groups, you've got informal groups, interest groups, friendship groups, and reference groups. And as I said, all of those groups effectively will tie in and there'll be certain overlap. And most people, and I would presume everybody in this room, belongs to more than one group because that's the nature of the whole thing. You have different sort of aspects. But how do we actually sort of look in terms of that? Why are we looking at groups in the first place? And why, from a PR point of view, is it such an important thing? Well, it helps us categorise people. It helps us classify folk and identify target audiences. It also informs us about people that effectively, if we know that there's, for instance, a group of carers for Alzheimer's patients, they will have certain particular characteristics, certain shared characteristics. So if we're talking about new treatments for Alzheimer's, for instance, then maybe you would need to target those groups first and foremost. If you're talking about, and certainly in terms of health aspects, whether it's cancer, whether it's Alzheimer's, whether it's even, as say, dyspraxic groups or people relating to other aspects, you've got a context of who your group is comprised of, what the sort of interests actually are, and where you're going to develop from that point of view. Normally, we actually tend to define the behaviour of groups by knowing who's actually part of them. So again, you can be negative, you can be positive. Football hooligans are a kind of group, but they're not necessarily positive. Rugby fans are a kind of group who may be positive. Yeah. Political leanings also adopt that. And what things happen with respect to group psychology? Well, there's a shared identity. They might wear the same clothes. They might wear the same style of outfits. They might wear similar forms of area. Now, I mean, the danger, of course, is that if you develop that to the ultimate extent, you can get the notion of you see the Boy Scouts, for instance, or the Guide Association as semi-fascist groups. Well, they're not, but they're still kind of tying into some of the sort of aspects that were used by fascist organisations in the 1920s and 30s to be part of that group, to be part of the group who effectively are seen as superior to society, etc. And also being part of the in-crowd. Who here has ever felt excluded from a particular group? Oh, it's just me then? Oh, fair enough. At some time in your life or lives, you know, you've got a situation whereby maybe people are talking about things that you're not part of, or that you don't know, and you might want to be part of it, you might not. But if you're part of that, there is that sense of commonality and the sense that you're part of the in-crowd. It almost goes back to being tribal. You remember that sort of notion about the primal brain where you sort of dial back and you sort of start saying, how are you getting primitive responses on this basis? Because it deals with your levels of self-esteem. And this is a really critical point. I mean, how do you define yourself? You know, does it really matter if you're not accepted by groups? Do you actually want to start off in your own group? Do you want to be part of the leaders, not the sheep? Where are you going to in terms of that? But is that level of self-esteem, you know, by which we kind of outline how confident, how positive we are, tied in with the sort of group? I mean, you could say one of the great things about PR, which we regularly say, is we have very small groups. Now, so I know I know everybody on the course, literally. I couldn't say I know everybody on the course in English, which I also teach on, but I know, in fact, I don't even know everybody on the 30-odd students I take for the modules that I teach for them for. Now, you might well say, well, that's great, because you want to be anonymous. But on the other hand, does that mean I can sort of respond to sort of thing to appropriately to sort of target things accordingly? Do you see what I mean in terms of the group and the way it's laid out and the size of the group can be important in terms of how you're working through that process? Because also what I've just done then, as I've introduced the whole notion of social comparisons. How does your group compare with other groups as well? Because the idea ultimately of this, as put forward, is that by understanding groups, you can better engage in terms of how that group operates and how it performs, etc. That then leads on to the next stage, which is group dynamics. And the psychologist who is most responsible for looking at group dynamics in the first half of the 20th century is a gentleman called Kurt Lewin, L-E-W-I-N, Kurt Lewin. Lewin actually coined the term group dynamics when he was describing the positive and negative forces that occur within groups of people. So it's Lewin that we have to when we talk about, well, what about the group dynamics? It's Lewin who effectively comes up with that. And what is group dynamics? Well, put quite simply, it's the attitudes and the behavioural patterns that you get in a group. It's how the group is formed. It's the structure of the group. So do you have alpha males, alpha females, whatever in that? It's how it functions. And it's also how it presents itself, both formally and informally. Now, ultimately, you could say that a group could be literally a duo. Any two or more people, obviously you'd have difficulty having a group of one because it doesn't make any sense, but two or more people who share a common meaning and a common evaluation of themselves can often come together to achieve a common goal. Example, the goal is to get an attendance for Chris Packer. You kind of believe in that, but how is that going to work? How is that going to be spread out? How is it going to be developed? You're working as a group to kind of allocate that and sort the thing through. And hopefully we'll succeed, otherwise we'll be very, very disappointed in you, but never mind, no pressure. If you're looking at the whole notion of work-based system, most evidence that is demonstrated suggests that groups typically outperform individuals. So the good thing about groups, as you might sort of imagine, is that working effectively, a good group will always beat an individual in terms of persuasions, etc. Especially when tasks that you're dealing with involve a variety of skills, a variety of experiences, and a variety of decision making. You know, it's the old, I mean, you could sort of say two hands make more hands make light work. I mean, you could also say too many chefs spoil the broth, but you know, broadly speaking, good groups can be flexible. You can assemble quickly, you can achieve goals, and then you can disband and move on to another set of objectives as well. So it becomes very organic in terms of how we see the group develop and how it's put together as well. Some things to bear in mind in terms of things that affect group behaviour. Well, these are fairly obvious, but structure. Who's in your group? Who actually sort of is the key member? Is it a case of you've got people who are kind of so full of their own ego that they actually become quite harmful? They're not willing to listen to other people's point of view. And as we've just said, the size of the group as well is also important. You know, if you're having to coordinate 10 people, it's easier than having to coordinate 100 people. So again, you need to work through that sort of process. And again, how do you actually develop roles within a group? So who's going to be the initiator? Who's going to come up with ideas? Who's going to actually provide information? Who's going to be the clarifier? Who's going to actually sort of explain those ideas? Who's going to actually sum up the whole thing, be the summariser? And, ultimately, test the ideas out. Do they work in practice? You know, this might be a great idea. You know, randomly, we'll think, we'll just basically sort of wait until we get to our first seminar group and then talk about sort of other bits and pieces for other things, etc. But the group roles, again, are important from that. Within the group itself, you also get a range of bonding activities. What we refer to as group cohesiveness. Now, the most common ways of bonding activities, again, there are about 7 of these, and the first one is to actually have shared goals. Shared goals that are actually there. The second one is how frequently you interact. So if you get together as a group and you only meet like once every 3 years, maybe it's not as effective as if you met once a month or, you know, once a fortnight, depending on the task that's actually involved, etc. Interesting enough, from a psychological point of view, also bonding can occur on levels of personal attractiveness. People bond on the basis of like, tying up with like, etc. And also, sometimes, shared alliances, so that you can actually deal with other group competition and so on, and external aspects. Also, how difficult is it to become a member of the group? You know, Groucho Marx once said he never wanted to join a club that would have him as a member. You know, the whole notion of how being part of a particular group, being part of the CIPR, for instance, being part of the PRCA, the Public Relations and Communications Association, you know, is it a case of anybody can join? No. Is it a case of you have to have a certain level of ability before you can join? Yes. Is that important? Or is it, you know, does that set up the exclusivity? Is that the British Medical Association, the NCTJ, you know, other areas that are sort of there? If you want to be part of that particular group, what sort of steps do you need to actually take part to work through that? And does that also lead to something which we call groupthink, where effectively you have one message that comes across and you're on message, and you might think that's great, that is a strength, and it could well be a strength, but it's also one of those areas and aspects that perhaps we need to just think about in terms of how it could be problematic as well. Within the group, you also need to think about social identity and how you actually view your own individual identity within the group. Is that seen as a positive thing? And do you compare yourself because you're part of X group as being better than Y? You know, you're much more sort of able because you are part of this particular group. And obviously, you know, say you're part of the University of Lincoln, you're much better than another university. Interesting enough, some techniques that we use to actually identify social identity are things like making sure that, or observations, that after sporting university groups that actually won games, there was more popularity, there was more tendency to actually wear university t-shirts after their university had won a particular game and a particular match. Because success, on whatever level, whether it's a sporting level, whether it's an academic level, etc., can lead to that notion of people wanting to be part of that social identity. People naturally want to gravitate towards and associate with winners. So if you're, you know, you're basically part of a winning team, you want to demonstrate you're part of the winning team. By, you know, as Joe's demonstrating today, is that University of Lincoln hoodie? Yay, right on, exactly. Critical, yes, it's showing that sort of, you know, success line from that point of view. And the gentleman who came up with that actually was a gentleman called Cialdini, spelled C-I-A-L-D-I-N-I, Robert Cialdini. And he was very much in terms of how social identity could be manifested and his observations with respect to that. It's also worthwhile noting what stages need to be gone through before new members to a group are accepted. How do you prove yourself as worthy of being accepted? What sort of stages do you go through? If you're a full member of the group, once you're in that, clearly you will probably have more privilege than any newcomers, but also you'll have more responsibility in ensuring that the goals are adhered to and so on. And then finally, marginal membership can often be, and people will just let things slide, so you don't renew your membership and you become a lapsed person for that particular thing. Again, there's the notion of whether they will be accepted back into the group, whether they'll be re-socialised. All right, I'll give a case in point. Zhao. Okay, some of us know Zhao, some of us never recurred to him. Had a meeting last week to actually discuss his state of play, which is even worse this year than last year. Strangely enough, he didn't show up. Shocker. We don't rule out the possibility of him coming back, but he's going to need a lot of re-socialisation to get into a stage of, as a level one student, resitting the first year, and at least you say, oh, thank God, I'm not going to encounter him ever again then. But, you know, it's just one of those problematic things in terms of, you know, we don't want to exclude him completely, but he's almost excluding himself. So we've had to start the process of basically, again, deselecting him from the programme and basically sort of de-enrolling him because he's not engaging with the process. It's that whole thing, and a decision had to be made there from the group membership. That one instance where, you know, I get alerts as the program leader in terms of when attendance is low or when people are dropping out and they drop below 60% or whatever, and then I can decide to either escalate that or see it on a one-to-one basis. And if I escalate it, then it involves Jason, which this one did because I can't do anything more at this particular stage, and so it goes. So you see the sort of systems we're using in terms of that group. You see the way it's working so far as, yeah, we'd like to if we can, re-admit and rejoin the group, but it needs to be a process of re-socialisation to actually do that, to basically say, okay, fine, if you want to be part of the public relations group doing undergraduate work at the University of Lincoln, you need to go through this, this and this. Moving on from that, in terms of the sort of closing side of things, etc., sometimes you need to be diplomatic, because if you go in all guns blazing, you have problems with respect to the likely response of that, and how that also relates to in-groups and out-groups. This was something that was actually put forward by a sociologist called William Sumner, S-U-M-N-E-R. And he suggested that basically humans as a species, or we are a species, that join together in groups naturally. It's what we do. You know, Chris Packham has his own group of climate change, extinction, rebellion people who say that the HS2 line is wrong, it's evil, it's bad, it should stop now. But there's obviously several opposing groups who say that actually HS2 is very good, it's essential, we need to have it, and the hell with the fact that it's going to slice through so much countryside in England. We don't mind, we don't care, we need progress, etc., etc. And that's one of the challenges that you get with what Sumner would refer to as in-groups and out-groups. Because as well as actually wanting to join together in groups, there's also a tendency that we have as humans to favour our own group over others, and also suggest that each group nourishes our own particular prides, our own vanity, we're superior. Pride comes before a fall. You've always got to, in a sense, have a sort of a notion that, okay, you're doing the best you can, you might have a very successful group, it is important for self-image that that group is seen as successful. But if you go in literally as we're the best thing going ever, it's not necessarily going to be the best way to actually build working relationships with other groups, etc. It's an interesting thing, and again, this is one that I think people have to decide, you know, what you're looking for. And it's something I'll go on to talk tomorrow with respect to another scientist or indeed sociologist called Solomon Asch, A-S-C-H. So with a C as opposed to just an A-S-H. And Asch actually conducted several experiments in what he called conformity studies, ways in which you would actually test people in terms of how they would actually operate were they going to conform or were they going to be different and so on. The difference between, obviously, at the heart of group theory, is it good to rebel? Well, maybe sometimes, but if you're too much of a rebel, if you're too much of an individual, do you then actually get into a situation whereby you become a positive danger to the group? Or should we celebrate the individuality of people? Or do we need to actually work at some way of combining the individuals within the group thing itself?